Emergency equipment. It took just over 4 minutes. Getting better, Morris noted, as the manned and ready calls were relayed to him by the CIC talker. Since leaving Norfolk 4 days before, Ferris was averaging 3 GQ calls per day, as ordered by Commander, Naval Surface Forces Atlantic. No one had confirmed it, but Morris figured that his friend's information had kicked over an anthill. His training routines had been doubled, and the orders for the increase of activity were classified as high as anything he had ever seen. More remarkably, the increased training tempos would interfere with maintenance scheduling, something not lightly set aside. "All stations report manned and ready," the talker finally announced. "Condition Zebra set throughout the ship." "Very well," the tactical action officer acknowledged. "Report, mister," Morris ordered. "Sir, the navigation and air search radars are in standby, and the sonar is in passive mode," replied the TAO. "Contact looks like a snorkeling submarine. Came in clear all at once. We've got a target motion analysis track going. His bearing is changing fore to aft and pretty fast, too. A little soon to be sure, but it's shaping up like he's on a reciprocal heading, probably no more than 10 miles out."
"Contact report off to Norfolk yet?"
"Waiting for your say-so." "Very well. Let's see how well we can run a hold-down exercise, mister."
Within 15 minutes, Ferris's helicopter was dropping Sana boys on the submarine, and the frigate was lashing it with her powerful active sonar. They wouldn't stop until the Soviet submarine admitted defeat by coming back to snorkeling depth, or until he evaded the frigate, which would put a large black mark in Morris's copybook. The objective of this non-lethal exercise was nasty enough: to break the submarine captain's confidence in his vessel, his crew, and himself. USS Chicago. They were 1,000 miles offshore, heading northeast at 25 knots. The crew was decidedly unhappy, though they'd all been through this before. What should have been a 3-week layover at Norfolk had been cut short at 8 days, a bitter pill after a long first cruise. Trips and vacations had been interrupted, and some minor maintenance work supposed to have been done by shoreside technicians was now being done round the clock by her own crew. McCafferty had announced his sealed orders to the crew 2 hours after diving. "Conduct 2 weeks of intensive tracking and torpedo drills. Then proceed to the Barents Sea for further intelligence gathering." It was important, he told them. They'd heard that one before, too.
Chapter 7. Initial Observations. Norfolk, Virginia. Toland hoped his uniform was properly arranged. It was 06:30 on a Wednesday morning, and he'd been up since 4 rehearsing his presentation, and cursing Sinclant for an early riser who probably wanted to get in a round of golf that afternoon. He would spend the afternoon, as he had for several weeks, sifting through endless intel documents and copies of Soviet publications in the intentions cubbyhole half a building away. The flag officer's briefing room seemed a different world from the rest of the tawdry building, but that was hardly a surprise. Admirals liked their comforts. Bob made a quick trip to the nearby head to eliminate a distraction caused by too much wake-up coffee. By the time he came back, the flag officers were filing in. They exchanged greetings, but there were no jokes. None of the banter one would expect this early in the morning. The officers selected their leather seats by order of rank. Those few who smoked had ashtrays. Each had a notepad. Stewards brought in several pots of coffee, cream, and sugar on silver trays, then withdrew. The cups were already in place. Each officer poured himself a cup as part of the morning ritual. Sinclant nodded to Toland.
"Good morning, gentlemen."
Approximately a month ago, 4 colonels in the Soviet Army, all regimental commanders in mechanized divisions,
were court-martialed and executed for falsifying data on their unit training and readiness reports, Toland began, explaining the significance of this. Earlier this week, Krasnaya Zvezda, Red Star, the daily newspaper of the entire Soviet military, publicized the execution of a number of privates in the Soviet Army. All but two were in the final 6 months of their enlistment period, and all were charged with disobeying the orders of their sergeants. Why is this significant? The Russian Army has long been known for its tough discipline. But as with many aspects of the Soviet Union, not everything is as it seems. A sergeant in the Soviet Army is not a professional soldier, as is the case in most armies. He is a conscript, just like the privates, selected early in his enlistment term for special training due to his intelligence, political reliability, or perceived leadership ability. He is sent to a tough 6-month course to make him an instant sergeant, then returned to his operational unit. In fact, he has about as little practical experience as his subordinates, and his superior knowledge of tactics and weapons use is a matter of increments rather than the more dramatic differences between sergeants and new recruits in Western forces. Because of this, the real pecking order in Soviet ground formations does not necessarily derive from rank, but from time in service. The Soviets induct their troops twice a year, in December and June. With the usual 2-year term of service, we see that there are 4 classes in any formation. The lowest class is in its first 6-month period, and the highest is in its 4th. The young men who have the actual status in a Soviet rifle company are those in their final 6-month term. They typically demand and get the best, or at least the most, food, uniforms, and work details. And they typically obviate the authority of the company NCOs. In fact, orders come directly from the officers, not the platoon and squad sergeants, and are usually carried out with little regard to what we consider conventional military discipline at the sub-officer level. As you can imagine, this places an enormous strain on the junior officers, and in many ways forces the officers to live with some things that they clearly do not and cannot like.
You're saying that their military formations operate under the principle of organized anarchy, observed the commander of Strike Fleet Atlantic. Their navy sure as hell doesn't.
That is true, sir. As we know, their seamen are in for 3 years instead of 2, and their situation, while similar, has many differences from that of the Soviet Army. And it would seem that this situation is ending in the Soviet Army as well. That subunit discipline is being quickly and vigorously reestablished.
Just how many privates got themselves popped?
Asked the general commanding 2nd Marine Division.
11, sir, listed by name and unit. That information is in your handout. Most were in their 4th class, meaning the last 6 months of their enlistment period.
Did the article you read make general conclusions? Sinklant asked.
No, Admiral. There is an unwritten rule in Soviet publications, both military and civilian, that you can criticize but not generalize. What that means is that individual screw-ups can be identified and castigated at length. But for political reasons, it is unacceptable to make general criticisms applying to a whole institution. You see, a critique that pointed to an all-pervasive condition would ipso facto critique Soviet society as a whole, and thereby the Communist Party, which oversees every aspect of Soviet life. It is a thin, but to them a philosophically important, distinction. In fact, when individual malefactors are named, the system as a whole is being criticized, but in a politically acceptable way. This article is a signal to every officer, NCO, and private soldier in the Soviet military. The times, they are a-changin'. The question we've been asking over in Intentions is, why? It would appear that this is not an isolated case of changing times. Toland flipped on an overhead projector and set a view graph in place. Within the Soviet Navy,
Surface-to-surface missile live fires are up 70% from last year. Not quite an all-time high, but, as you can see from this graph, pretty close to it. Submarine deployments, mainly those for diesel subs, are down. And intelligence reports tell us that an unusually high number of submarines are in the yards for what appears to be routine but unscheduled maintenance. We have reason to believe that this situation is connected with a nationwide shortage of lead-acid batteries. It appears likely that all Soviet submarines are undergoing battery replacement, and that regular battery production is being redirected to militarily important segments of the Soviet economy. We have also noted higher levels of activity by Soviet naval surface forces, naval aviation units, and other long-range aircraft formations, again with increased weapons exercises. Finally, there has been an increase in the time away from port days of Soviet surface combatants. Although this number represents a small increase, operational patterns are different from what we've become accustomed to. Instead of sailing from one point to another and just dropping the hook, their surface combatants appear to be running more realistic exercises. They've done this before, but never without announcing it. So what we are seeing in the Soviet Navy is an extensive stand-down accompanied by increasing tempos in the actual exercises that are being run. Matched with what we're seeing in the Soviet Army and Air Force, it appears that their military readiness is being increased across the board. At the same time that they are proposing reductions in strategic nuclear weapons, their conventional forces are rapidly improving their ability to engage in combat operations. We, in intentions, regard this combination of factors as potentially dangerous.
"Looks kind of hazy to me," an admiral said around his pipe. "How are we supposed to persuade somebody that this means anything?"
"A good question, sir. Any of these indicators taken in isolation would appear entirely logical in and of itself. What concerns us is why they are all happening at once. The problem of manpower utilization in the Soviet military has been around for generations. The problem of training norms and integrity in their officer corps is not exactly new either. What caught my interest was the battery thing. We are seeing the beginnings of what could become a major disruption within the Soviet economy. The Russians plan everything centrally in their economy and on a political basis as well. The main factory that makes batteries is operating 3 shifts instead of the usual 2, so production is up. But supply in the civilian economy is down. In any case, Admiral, you're correct. Individually, these things mean nothing at all. It's only when taken in combination that we see anything to be concerned about."
"But you're concerned," Sinclair said.
"Yes, sir."
"Me too, son.
What else are you doing about it?" "We have an inquiry into SACUR to notify us of anything they think is unusual in the current activities of the group of Soviet forces in Germany. The Norwegians have increased their surveillance in the Barents Sea. We're starting to get more access to satellite photography of ports and fleet bases. DIA has been informed of our data and is running its own investigation. More bits and pieces are beginning to show up."
"What about CIA?
DIA is handling that for us through their headquarters at Arlington Hall.
"When do their spring maneuvers begin?" Sinclair asked.
"Sir, the annual Warsaw Pact spring exercise, they're calling it Progress this year, is scheduled to begin in 3 weeks. There are indications that in keeping with the spirit of détente, the Soviets will invite NATO military representatives to keep an eye on things, and Western news crews as well."
"I'll tell you what's scary about this,"
Commander, Naval Surface Forces, Atlantic, grunted.
"All of a sudden, they've started doing what we've always asked them to do."
"Try selling that to the papers," Commander, Naval Forces, Atlantic, suggested.
"Recommendations?" Sinclair asked his operations officer.
"We're already running a pretty active training schedule ourselves. I don't suppose it would hurt to beef that up.
Toland, you said that what tipped you to this situation was this battery thing in the civilian economy. Are you looking for other economic disruptions?
Yes, sir, we are.
That's DIA's brief, and my contact in Arlington Hall is also asking CIA to run some additional checks. If I might amplify on this point, gentlemen, the Soviet economy is centrally managed, as I said earlier. Those industrial plans they have are fairly rigid. They don't deviate from them lightly, since those deviations tend to have a ripple effect throughout the economy as a whole. Disruption may be too strong a word at present.
You just have a nasty suspicion, Sinclant said.
Fine, Toland. That's what we pay you for. Good brief.
Bob took his cue and left. The admirals stayed put to talk things over.
It was a relief to leave. Much as he liked the attention, being examined by senior officials like a tissue culture on a petri dish could make you old rather quickly. He walked through a covered walkway back to his building and watched the late arrivals wander about looking for parking places. The grass was greening up. A civilian crew was mowing while another was fertilizing. The shrubbery was already beginning to grow, and he hoped they'd let the bushes expand a bit before they trimmed them back again. Norfolk could be pleasant in the spring, he knew, with the fragrance of azaleas on the salt-laden air. He wondered how pleasant it would be in summer.
"How'd it go?" Chuck asked.
Toland stripped off his jacket and allowed his knees to sag theatrically in front of the Marine.
"Pretty well. Nobody snapped my head off." "Didn't want to worry you before, but there's people in there been known to do that. They say Sinclant likes nothing better for breakfast than fried commander garnished with diced lieutenant."
"Big surprise. He's an admiral, isn't he?" "I've done briefs before, Chuck." All Marines thought all sailors were wimps, Toland reminded himself. No sense giving Chuck more encouragement for that view.
"Any conclusions?"
"Sinclant Ops talked about increasing training schedules. I got excused right after that."
"Good. We ought to have a packet of satellite shots later today. There are some questions coming in from Langley and Arlington. Nothing firm yet, but I think they might be stumbling onto some odd data. If it turns out you're right, Bob, well, you know how it works."
"Sure. Somebody closer to D.C. will make the discovery." "Shit, I don't care about that, Chuck. I want to be wrong. I want this whole friggin' thing to blow over. Then I can go home and play in my garden."
"Well, maybe I got some good news for you. We got our TV tied into a new satellite receiver. I talked the communications guys into letting us tap into Russian television to catch their evening news. We won't learn anything hard, but it's a good way of catching moods. Just tried it out before you got here, and found out Ivan's running a film festival for all of Sergei Eisenstein's classics. Tonight, the battleship Potemkin, followed by all the others, and ending on May 30th with Alexander Nevsky."
"Oh? I have Nevsky on tape."
"Yeah? Well, they took the original negatives, flew them to EMI in London to make digitalized masters, and re-recorded the original Prokofiev score on a Dolby format. We'll be making tapes. Your machine VHS or Beta?"
"VHS." Toland laughed.
"Maybe this job has a few bennies after all."
"So, what new stuff do we have?"
Lowe handed him a 6-inch file of documents.
"Time to get back to work." Toland settled in his chair and began sorting through the papers.
Kiev, the Ukraine.
"Things are looking better, comrade," Alexeyev reported. "Discipline in the officer corps has improved immeasurably. The exercise with 261st Guards went very well this morning."
"And 173rd Guards?" Sink Southwest asked.
"They too need further work, but they should be ready in time," Alexeyev said confidently. "The officers are acting like officers. Now we need to get the privates to act like soldiers.
We'll see when progress begins.
We must have our officers turn away from the usual set-piece choreography and seek realistic engagement scenarios. We can use progress to identify leaders who cannot adapt to a real combat environment and replace them with younger men who can.
He sat down opposite his commander's desk. Alexeyev calculated that he was exactly 1 month behind in his sleep.
"You look weary, Pasha," Sink Southwest observed.
"No, Comrade Colonel, I haven't had the time," Alexeyev chuckled.
"But if I make one more helicopter trip, I think I shall sprout wings."
"Pasha, I want you to go home and not return for 24 hours."
If you were a horse," the general observed, "you would have broken down by now."
"This is an order from your commander-in-chief. 24 hours of rest.
I would prefer it that you spend it all sleeping, but that is your affair.
Think, Pavel Leonidovich.
Were we now engaged in combat operations, you would be better rested. Regulations require it. A harsh lesson from our last war with the Germans. I need your talents unhindered. And if you drive yourself too hard now, you won't be worth a damn when I really need you. I will see you at 1600 tomorrow to go over our plan for the Persian Gulf. You will be clear of eye and straight of back."
Alexeyev stood. His boss was a gruff old bear, so much like his own father had been, and a soldier's soldier.
"Let the record show that I obey all orders from my commander-in-chief."
Both men laughed. Both needed it.
Alexeyev left the office and walked downstairs to his official car. When it arrived at the apartment block a few kilometers away, the driver had to awaken his general.
USS Chicago.
"Close approach procedures," McCafferty ordered.
McCafferty had been tracking a surface ship for 2 hours, ever since his sonarmen had detected her at a range of 44 miles. The approach was being made on sonar only, and, under the captain's orders, sonar had not told the fire control party what they were tracking. For the time being, every surface contact was being treated as a hostile warship.
"Range 3,500 yards, the executive officer reported. "Bearing 142, speed 18 knots, course 261.
"Up scope," McCafferty ordered.
The attack periscope slid up from its well on the starboard side of the pedestal. A quartermaster's mate got behind the instrument, dropped the handles in place, and trained it to the proper bearing. The captain sighted the crosshairs on the target's bow.
"Bearing. Mark."
The quartermaster squeezed the button on the pickle, transmitting the bearing to the MK-117 fire control computer.
"Angle on the bow, starboard, 20.
The fire control technician punched the data into the computer. The microchips rapidly computed distances and angles.
"Solution set. Ready for tubes 3 and 4.
"Okay."
McCafferty stepped back from the periscope and looked over at the exec.
"You want to see what we killed?"
"Damn."
The executive officer laughed and lowered the periscope.
"Move over, Otto Kretschmer."
McCafferty picked up the microphone, which went to speakers throughout the submarine.
"This is the captain speaking. We just completed the tracking exercise. For anyone who's interested, the ship we just killed is the Universe Ireland, 340,000 tons worth of ultra-large crude carrier. That is all."
He put the mic back in its cradle.
"Exo, critique?"
"It was too easy, Skipper," the executive officer said. "His speed and course were constant. We might have shaved 4 or 5 minutes on the target motion analysis right after we acquired him, but we were looking for a zigzag instead of a constant course. For my money, it's better to proceed like that on a slow target. I'd say we have things going pretty well."
McCafferty nodded agreement. A high-speed target, like a destroyer, might well head directly for them.
The slow ones would probably be altering course constantly under wartime conditions.
We're getting there.
The captain looked over to his fire control party.
That was well done. Let's keep it that way.
The next time, McCafferty thought, he'd arrange for sonar not to report a target until it got really close. Then he'd see how fast his men could handle a snapshot engagement. Until then, he decided on a strenuous series of computer-simulated engagement drills.
Norfolk, Virginia.
Those are batteries.
Okay, it's confirmed.
Lowe handed over the satellite photographs. A number of trucks were visible, and though most had their load beds covered by canvas, the load beds of three were exposed to the high-flying satellite. What he saw were the bathtub shapes of oversized battery cells, and gangs of seamen manhandling them across a pier.
How old are these shots? Toland asked.
18 hours.
Would have been useful this morning, the younger man grumped. Looks like three tangos nested together. These are 10-ton trucks. I count 9 of them. I checked around. Each individual battery cell weighs 218 kilograms empty.
Ouch! How many to fill up a sub?
A lot. Toland grinned.
We don't know that exactly. I found 4 different estimates with a 30% spread. It probably differs from ship to ship anyway. The more you build of a design, the more you're tempted to fool around with it. That's what we do.
Toland looked up.
We need more access to these.
Already taken care of. From here on, we're on the distribution list for all shots of naval sites.
What do you think of the activity for the surface ships?
Toland shrugged.
The photographs showed perhaps a dozen surface combatants, ranging from cruisers to corvettes. The decks of all were littered with cables and crates. A large number of men were visible.
You can't tell much from this.
No cranes, so nothing massive was being unloaded, but cranes can move, too.
That's the problem with ships. Everything you need to know about is under cover. All we can tell from these photos is that they're tied alongside. Anything else is pure supposition. Even with the subs, we're inferring that they're loading batteries aboard.
Come on, Bob, Lowe snorted.
Think about it, Chuck, Toland replied.
They know what our satellites are for, right? They know what their orbital paths are, and they know when they will be at any given point in space. If they really want to fake us out, how hard is it? If your mission was to fake out satellites, and you knew when they came, you think you might play games with the other guy's head? We depend too much on these things. They're useful as hell, sure, but they have their limitations. It'd be nice to get some human intelligence on this.
Polyanyi, RSFSR.
There's just something weird about watching a guy pour cement into a ship, Flynn observed on the ride back to Murmansk. No one had ever told him about ballast.
Ah, but it can be a beautiful thing, exclaimed their escort, a junior captain in the Soviet Navy.
Now if only your navies can do the same.
The small press group that had been allowed to stand on a pier and watch the neutralization of the first 2 Yankee-class fleet ballistic missile submarines was being carefully managed, Flynn and Calloway noted. They were being driven around in groups of 2 and 3, each group with a naval officer and a driver. Hardly unexpected, of course. Both men were amazed that they were being allowed onto so sensitive a base at all.
A pity that your president did not allow a team of American officers to observe this, the escort went on.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there, Captain, Flynn nodded. It would have made a much better story. As it was, a Swede and an Indian officer, neither a submariner, had gotten a closer look at what the reporters called the cement ceremony, and reported somberly afterward that, yes, cement had been poured into each missile launch tube on the 2 submarines.
Flynn had timed the length of each pour, and would do some checking when he got back. What was the volume of a missile tube? How much cement to fill it? How long to pour the cement? Even so, Captain, you must agree that the American response to your country's negotiating position has been extremely positive. Through all this, William Calloway kept his peace and stared out the car's window. He'd covered the Falkland Islands War for his wire service and spent a lot of time with the Royal Navy, both afloat and in naval shipyards watching preparations for sending the Queen's fleet south. They were now passing by the piers and work areas for a number of surface warships. Something was wrong here, but he couldn't quite pin it down. What Flynn did not know was that his colleague often worked informally for the British Secret Intelligence Service. Never in a sensitive capacity, the man was a correspondent, not a spy, but, like most reporters, he was a shrewd, observant man, careful to note things that editors would never allow to clutter up a story. He didn't even know who the station chief in Moscow was, but he could report on this to a friend in Her Majesty's embassy. The data would find its way to the right person.
"So what does our English friend think of Soviet shipyards?" the captain inquired with a broad smile.
"Far more modern than ours," Calloway replied. "And I gather you don't have dockyard unions, Captain?" The officer laughed.
"We have no need for unions in the Soviet Union. Here the workers already own everything."
That was the standard party line, both reporters noted. "Of course." "Are you a submarine officer?" the Englishman inquired.
"No,"
the captain exclaimed. A hearty laugh. Russians are big on laughs when they want to be, Flynn thought.
"I come from the steppes. I like blue sky and broad horizons. I have great respect for my comrades on submarines, but I have no wish to join them."
"My feelings exactly, Captain," Calloway agreed. "We elderly Brits like our parks and gardens."
"What sort of sailor are you?" "I have shore assignment now, but my last ship was Leonid Brezhnev, icebreaker. We do some survey work, and also make a way for merchant ships along the Arctic coast to the Pacific."
"That must be a demanding job," Calloway said.
"And a dangerous one."
"Keep talking, old boy."
"It demands caution, yes, but we Russians are accustomed to cold and ice. It is a proud task to aid the economic growth of your country."
"I could never be a sailor," Calloway went on. He saw a curious look in Flynn's eyes. "The hell you couldn't."
"Too much work, even when you're in port. Like now. Are your shipyards always this busy?" "Ah, this is not busy," the captain said without much thought.
The man from Reuters nodded. The ships were cluttered, but there was not that much obvious activity. Not so many people moving about. Many cranes were still. Trucks were parked. But the surface warships and auxiliaries were cluttered as if... He checked his watch. 3:30 in the afternoon. The workday was hardly over. "A great day for East-West détente," he said to cover his feelings. "A great story for Pat and me to tell our readers."
"This is good."
The captain smiled again.
"It is time we had real peace."
The correspondents were back in Moscow 4 hours later, after the usual uncomfortable ride on an Aeroflot jet with its Torquemada seats. The two reporters walked to Flynn's car. Calloway's was still hors de combat with mechanical problems. He grumbled at having gotten a Soviet car instead of bringing his Morris over with him. Bloody impossible to get parts.
"A good story today, Patrick?"
"You bet. But I wish we'd been able to snap a picture or two." They were promised Sov photo shots of the cement ceremony.
"What did you think of the shipyard?"
"Big enough. I spent a day at Norfolk once. They all look alike to me." Calloway nodded thoughtfully. Shipyards do look alike, he thought. But why did Polyarny seem strange? his suspicious reporter's mind? The constant question. What is he, she, it hiding? But the Soviets had never allowed him on a naval base, and this was his third tour in Moscow. He'd been to Murmansk before. Once he'd spoken with the mayor and asked how the naval personnel affected his administration of the city. There were always uniforms visible on the street. The mayor had tried to evade the question and finally said, "There are no navy in Murmansk." A typical Russian answer to an awkward question. But now they'd let a dozen Western reporters into one of their most sensitive bases. QED, they were not hiding anything. Or were they? After he filed his story, Calloway decided, he'd have a brandy with his friend at the embassy. Besides, there was a party celebrating something or other. He arrived at the embassy, on Marisa Teresa embankment, across the river from the Kremlin walls, just after 9 o'clock that night. It turned into four brandies. By the fourth, the correspondent was going over a map of the naval base and using his trained memory to indicate just what activity he'd seen where. An hour later, the data was encrypted and cabled to London. Chapter 8. Further Observations. Grassau, German Democratic Republic. The TV news crew was having a great time. It had been years since they'd been allowed to film a Soviet military unit in action, and the entertainment value of the mistakes they saw gave plenty of spice for a piece on the NBC Nightly News. As they watched, a tank battalion was stalled at a crossroads on Highway 101, 50 kilometers south of Berlin. They'd taken a wrong turn somewhere, and the battalion commander was screaming at his subordinates. After 2 minutes of that, a captain stepped forward and made a few gestures at the map. A major was banished from the scene as the younger man apparently solved the problem. The camera followed the dejected major into a staff car, which drove north along the main road. 5 minutes later, the battalion was mounted and rolling. The news crew took its time reloading its equipment into their carry-all, and the chief reporter took the time to walk over to a French officer who had also observed the procedure. The Frenchman was a member of the Joint Military Liaison Group, a convenient leftover of the Second World War which enabled both sides to spy on each other. A lean, poker-faced man, he wore paratrooper's wings and smoked Gauloises. He was an intelligence officer, of course. "What do you make of this, Major?" the NBC reporter asked. "They made a mistake 4 kilometers back. They should have turned left, but didn't." A Gallic shrug. "Not very impressive performance for the Russians, is it?" the reporter laughed. The Frenchman was more thoughtful. "Did you notice that they had a German officer with them?" The reporter had noticed the different uniform but not realized its significance. "Oh, is that what he was? Why didn't they ask him for help?" "Yes," the French major answered. He didn't say that this was the fourth time he had seen a Soviet officer refrain from asking assistance from his East German guide, and all in the last 2 days. To have Soviet units get lost was an old story. The Russians used a different alphabet in addition to the different language. That made it easy to make navigational errors, and the Soviets always had DDR officers along to help them find their way around. Until now. He flicked his cigarette onto the road. "What else did you notice, monsieur?" "The colonel was pretty mad at that major. Then a captain, I think, showed him the mistake, I guess, and how to correct it." "How long?" "Less than 5 minutes after they stopped." "Very good." The Frenchman smiled. The major was heading back to Berlin, and that battalion had a new operations officer now. The smile disappeared. "Looks pretty dumb to get lost like that, doesn't it?" The Frenchman got back into his car to follow the Russians. "Have you ever gotten lost in a foreign country, monsieur?"
Yes, who hasn't?
But they found their mistake quickly, no?
The major waved to his driver to pull off.
And all by themselves this time, he thought.
Intéressant.
The TV reporter shrugged and walked back to his own vehicle. He followed the last tank in line, annoyed that they were moving at only 30 kilometers per hour. The tanks moved northwest at that speed until they reached Highway 187, where, miraculously, they joined up with another Soviet unit, and, dropping back to their normal speed of 20 kilometers per hour, resumed their progress west toward the exercise area. Norfolk, Virginia. It was impressive. As they watched the Moscow television news program, a whole regiment of tanks advanced across a flat landscape. Their objective turned to a horizontal fountain of dirt as an artillery barrage pounded the simulated enemy positions. Fighter bombers streaked across the sky, and helicopters performed their own death dance. The voiceover commentary proclaimed the readiness of the Soviet Army to meet any foreign threat. It certainly looked that way. The next 5-minute segment concerned the Vienna arms talks. There was the usual complaint about how the United States was fighting over certain aspects of the clearly generous original Soviet proposal. But the speaker went on to say that real progress was being made despite American intransigence, and that a comprehensive agreement was possible by the end of summer. Toland was puzzled by the nature of the Soviet description of the negotiations. He'd never paid much attention to this sort of rhetoric before, and found the good guy, bad guy descriptions curious.
"Pretty normal stuff," Lowe responded to the question. "You'll know the deal is close to being struck when the beefs start disappearing. Then they talk about how enlightened our president is for a class enemy. They can get real euphoric around signing time. Really, this stuff is pretty mild. Think about it. What sort of language do they usually use about us?"
"The exercise looked normal."
"It's normal, all right. Ever think about how much fun it is to face 100 tanks? You did notice that they all carry 5-inch guns. Then think about the artillery support they get. Then think about the aircraft. The Russians are real believers in this combined arms stuff. When they come at you, they come with the whole inventory. They have this set-piece stuff down cold.
How do we counter it?"
"You take the initiative. You let the other guy get all set to fight his battle his way, son. You might as well bag it."
"Same story at sea."
"Yeah."
Kiev, the Ukraine. Alexeyev atypically poured himself a cup of tea at the corner table before approaching his commander's desk. When he walked over, his grin was a meter wide.
"Comrade General, progress goes well."
"So I can see, Pavel Leonidovich."
"I would never have believed it. The improvement in our officer corps is extraordinary. The dead wood is being disposed of, and those men whom we've moved up to new posts are eager and capable."
"So, shooting those 4 colonels has worked,"
Sink Southwest noted sardonically. He'd run the first 2 days of the exercise from his command headquarters and yearned to get into the field where the real action was. But that was not a theater commander's job. Alexeyev was his best set of eyes for what was really happening.
"A hard choice, but a good one. The results speak for themselves."
The edge came off the younger man's enthusiasm. His conscience still remembered that. The problem with hard decisions, he learned, was not making them, but learning to live with the consequences, however necessary. He set the thought aside yet again. "With 2 more weeks of intensive exercises, the Red Army will be ready. We can do it. We can defeat NATO."
"We don't have to fight NATO, Pasha."
"Then Allah help the Arabs," Alexeyev said.
"Allah help us. West gets another of our tank divisions."
The general held up a dispatch.
"The one you were with today, in fact. I wonder how he has been doing." my spies tell me, quite well.
And you have joined the KGB, Pasha?
A classmate of mine is on SyncWest's staff. They, too, have adopted a policy for eliminating incompetence. I have seen the benefits. A new man in a posting has much better incentive to do his job properly than one for whom it has become routine.
Except at the top, of course.
Commander-in-Chief West is one man I never expected to defend, but everything I've been told leads me to believe he's getting his forces ready in the same way as we.
Things must indeed be improved if you are this magnanimous.
They are, comrade. Another tank division lost to Germany. Well, he needs it more than we. I tell you, we will sweep the Arabs aside like dirt on a smooth tile floor. In truth, we always could. There are not so many of them, and if these Arabs are like the Libyans I saw 3 years ago, these have no mountains to hide in. This is not Afghanistan. Our mission is to conquer, not to pacify. This we can do. I estimate 2 weeks. The only problem I foresee is the destruction of the oil fields. They can use scorched earth as a defense, just as we have, and that will be difficult for us to prevent, even with paratroops. Still and all, our objective is achievable. Our men will be ready.
Chapter 9. A Final Look. Norfolk, Virginia.
There's something to be said for instant traditions, Chuck. This was their fourth Russian movie via satellite. Toland handed over the bowl of popcorn. It'll be a pity to lose you back to the Corps.
Bite your tongue. 1600 hours Tuesday, Colonel Charles de Winter Lowe goes back into the marine business. I'll leave the paper shuffling to you squids.
Toland laughed.
And you won't miss the evening movie?
Maybe a little.
Half a mile away, a satellite receiver was tracking a Soviet communications satellite. They'd been pirating signals off this satellite and two of her sisters for weeks now, to keep tabs on the Soviet TV news, and also to catch the evening movie. Both men admired the work of Sergei Eisenstein. And Alexander Nevsky was his masterwork. Toland popped open a can of Coke.
I wonder how Ivan would react to a John Ford Western. Somehow I get the feeling that Comrade Eisenstein might have been exposed to one or two.
Yeah, the Duke would have fit in pretty good here. Or better yet, Errol Flynn.
You heading home tonight?
Right after the movie. God, a 4-day weekend off. Can I stand the strain?
The titles showed a new frame, different from the one on his personal tape of the movie back home. The original soundtrack dialogue had been retained and cleaned up somewhat, but the music had been redone by the Moscow State Symphony and Chorus. They did true justice to Prokofiev's evocative score.
The film began with a view of the Russian steppes, Toland wondered. Or was that supposed to be the southern part of the country?
Anyway, it showed rolling grassland littered with bones and weapons from an old battle against the Mongols. The Yellow Peril, still a Russian bugaboo. The Soviet Union had absorbed a lot of Mongols, but now the Chinese had nuclear weapons and the world's largest army.
"The print is terrific," Lowe observed.
"Hell of a lot better than my tape," Toland agreed.
A pair of VHS machines was recording this, though the Navy wasn't supplying the tapes. Each officer had bought one himself. Sack Lance Inspector General had an evil reputation. All this happened pretty close to the Baltic coast, Toland reminded himself. The introduction of the main character was made through a song as he was evidently out directing some men with a fishing net. A good socialist introduction, the officers agreed. The hero outdoing manual labor. A brief verbal confrontation with the Mongols, then a musing about which danger to Russian integrity was greater, the German or the Mongol.
Jesus, you know they still think that way, Toland chuckled.
The more things change.
Lowe popped open his own Coke.
I kinda wonder about this guy, though. When he went back into the water after the net, he ran like a girl, what with his arms flying all over.
"You should try running in knee-deep water," the Marine growled.
And the scene shifted to the German danger.
A bunch of out-of-work knights, just like the Crusades. Hell, just like Indian movies from the 30s. Chopping people up, throwing babies into the fire.
You suppose they really did things like that?
Ever hear of a place called Auschwitz, Bob? Lowe inquired. You know, in the civilized 20th century?
Those guys didn't bring a bishop with them.
Try reading up on the Crusaders' liberation of Jerusalem. Either they killed, or raped first and then killed, all for the greater glory of God, with bishops and cardinals cheering them on.
Nice bunch.
Yeah, it's probably true enough. Christ knows the Eastern Front in 41-45 saw a lot of it on both sides.
Nasty campaign, that was.
Want some more popcorn?
Finally, the people mobilized themselves, especially the peasants.
Vistavajte, люди русские, на славный бой, на смертный бой.
Damn, Толанд sat forward. They really punched that song up. The soundtrack was almost perfect, even accounting for the satellite transmission difficulties.
Arise, you Russian people, in a just battle, in a fight to the death. Arise, you people free and brave. Defend our fair native land.
Toland counted more than 20 specific uses of the word Russia, or Russian.
That's odd, he observed. They're trying to get away from that. The Soviet Union is supposed to be all one happy family, not the new Russian Empire.
I guess you'd call it an historical quirk, Lowe commented. Stalin commissioned the film to alert his people to the Nazi threat. Old Joe was a Georgian, but he turned out to be one hell of a Russian nationalist.
Strange,
but he was one strange dude.
The movie was clearly a production of the 1930s. The strident characters were right out of John Ford or Raoul Walsh. A standalone heroic figure in Prince Alexander Nevsky. Two brave but buffoonish sidekicks. And the de rigueur love interest. The German enemies were arrogant and, for the most part, invisible behind unlikely helmets designed by Eisenstein himself. The invading Germans had already divided up Russia amongst themselves. One knight made Prince of Pskov, where in a horrible example of pacification the invaders had slaughtered men, women, and children. The children were thrown into a bonfire to show who was boss. The great battle scene took place on a frozen lake.
What kind of lunatic is going to fight on a frozen lake when he's wearing a half-ton of sheet steel? Toland groaned.
Lowe explained that it had really happened that way, more or less.
I'm sure they played around with it some, like they died with their boots on, the colonel observed. But the battle really happened.
The battle was a truly epic scene. The German knights attacked with casual disregard for proper tactics, and the Russian peasants, ably led by Alexander and his two sidekicks, encircled them with a canny-like envelopment maneuver. Then, of course, came single combat between Prince Alexander and the German chieftain. There was no doubt of the outcome. Their commander vanquished in single combat, the German ranks came apart, and when they tried to rally on the edge of the lake, the ice gave way, drowning nearly everyone.
That's realistic enough, Lowe chuckled. Think how many armies have been swallowed up by the Russian countryside.
The remainder of the movie resolved the love interest. Each buffoon got himself a pretty girl, and liberated Pskov. Curiously, while the prince hoisted a bunch of children into his saddle for the ride in, he never showed the slightest interest in female company, and ended with a sermon, Alexander standing alone and speaking about what happens to people who invade Russia.
Trying to make Nevsky look like Stalin, eh?
There is some of that, Lowe agreed. The strong man, all alone, a fatherly benefactor.
Some benefactor.
Anyway you cut it, this is just about the best propaganda movie ever made.
The punchline is that when Russia and Germany signed their non-aggression pact a year later, Eisenstein was detailed to direct a stage production of Wagner's The Valkyries. Call it penance for offending the German sensibilities.
Oof.
You study these guys more than I do, Chuck. Colonel Lowe pulled a cardboard box from under his desk and began to load up his personal effects.
Yeah, well, if you have to face the possibility of fighting a man, you might as well learn all you can about him.
You think we will?
Lowe frowned briefly.
I saw enough of that in Nam, but that's what they pay us for, isn't it?
Toland stood and stretched. He had a 4-hour drive ahead of him.
Colonel, it has been a pleasure for this squid to work with you.
It hasn't been half bad for this jarhead.
Hey, when I get the family set up down in Lejeune, why don't you come on down sometime? There's some great fishing down there.
Deal.
They shook hands.
Good luck with your regiment, Chuck.
Good luck here, Bob.
Toland walked out to his car. He'd already packed up and drove quickly out Terminal Boulevard to Interstate 64. The worst part of the drive home was the traffic to the Hampton Roads tunnel, after which things settled down to the usual superhighway rat race. All the way home, Toland's mind kept going over the scenes from Eisenstein's movie. The one that kept coming back was the most horrible of all. A German knight, wearing a crusader's cross, tearing a Pskov infant from his mother's breast, and throwing him, her, into a fire. Who could see that and not be enraged? No wonder the rabble-rousing song, "Arise, You Russian People," had been a genuinely popular favorite for years. Some scenes cried out for bloody revenge, the theme for which was Prokofiev's fiery call to arms. Soon he found himself humming the song.
"A real intelligence officer you are," Toland smiled to himself, "thinking just like the people you're supposed to study. Defend our fair native land.
Za nashu zemlyu chestnuyu."
"Excuse me, sir?" the toll collector asked. Toland shook his head. Had he been singing aloud? He handed over the 75 cents with a sheepish grin. What would this lady think? An American naval officer singing in Russian?
Moscow, RSFSR. It was just after midnight when the truck drove north across the Kameny Bridge to Borovitskaya Square and turned right, toward the Kremlin. The driver stopped for the first group of Kremlin guards. Their papers were fully in order, of course, and they were waved through. The truck pulled up to the second checkpoint by the Kremlin Palace, where their papers were also in order. From there it was 500 meters to the service entrance of the Council of Ministers building.
"What are you delivering this time of day, comrades?" the Red Army captain asked.
"Cleaning supplies. Come, I will show you."
The driver got out and walked slowly around the back of the truck.
"Must be nice working here at night when things are so peaceful."
"True enough," the captain agreed.
He'd go off duty in another 90 minutes.
"Here." The driver pulled back the canvas cover. There were 12 cans of industrial-strength solvent and a crate of hardware parts.
"German supplies?"
The captain was surprised. He'd been on Kremlin duty for only 2 weeks.
"Da, the Krauts make very efficient cleaning machinery, and the Vlasti make use of it. This is carpet cleaning fluid. This is for lavatory walls. This one here is for windows. The crate. Ah, I will open it."
The lid came off easily since the nails had already been loosened.
"As you see, comrade captain, parts for some of the machines."
He smirked.
"Even German machines break."
"Open one of the cans," the captain ordered.
"Sure, but you won't like the smell. Which one do you want opened?"
The driver picked up a small pry bar.
"That one."
The captain pointed to a can of bathroom cleaner. The driver laughed.
"The worst smelling of all. Stand back, comrade.
We don't want to splash this slop on your clean uniform.
The captain was new enough on the job that he scrupulously did not step back.
Good, the driver thought.